The Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Rachel Rudolph. Rachel is managing editor of Encompassing Crescent. It's an online monthly magazine designed to bring together academics, activists, journalists, policymakers, and political figures to facilitate and promote dialogue on vital global issues. What better an initiative than that? She also heads the International Relations for Facilitate Global. It's an NGO promoting peace, human rights, and economic change. Well, I'll add that to the previous comment. And right now, Rachel is my first ever guest from Saudi Arabia. My goodness. She is there researching a book, and it's on Saudi Western relations. And Rachel, I welcome you, and I look forward to when the book will come out, because I'll certainly have you back to talk about it. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I will actually, I'm supposed to deliver a draft, or the final draft of the manuscript, August of this year, at the end of August. So it will be out before the end of 2012.
Oh, marvelous, marvelous.
Well, the publisher is I.B. Taurus.
Well, that's a key subject. I mean, the Saudi-U.S. relationship goes back a great many years. I'm not certain how far it goes back, but I do remember it was sometime around World War II or thereafter, when Roosevelt met the king, Saudi king, on a U.S. warship. Well, you know more about that than I do. They struck a deal. You know, we guarantee their security, they guarantee us oil, something like that.
We've had, it's quite complex. It's a decades-long relationship, one that has been primarily security and economic related, but there have been attempts to create cultural dialogue and bridges between the different cultures, because one of the things that's lacking in Saudi-U.S. relations is a lack of understanding, especially from a Western perspective. And in fact, the very first chapter that I'm working on looks at Western, in particular U.S. perception of Saudi Arabia from 1970s to the present. Because if you go back to U.S.-Saudi relations, it's in 1973 that there was a spark in, or an intensification of relations between the two countries.
Well, 73 was a momentous year. I remember the day when it began, October that year, the so-called Yom Kippur War. I don't really remember it. I remember where it was and what I was doing the moment I got the word about it. I don't know why that's the case, Rachel. Occasionally something happens, an event of some importance, which is fine as in and of itself, but to remember where I was and what I was doing seems a little odd. A real major thing, like the beginning of World War II, World War II or even World War I, well, that began incrementally, World War II, you know, as far as America went, Pearl Harbor, to remember where you were that day is certainly something of some note. Well, I was only a kid, so I don't remember where I was. I mean, I was too young to even know what was going on, but I do remember the Yom Kippur War. I remember the day that Kennedy was assassinated, and a few other things stand out in my mind. I don't know a lot about U.S.-Saudi relations, though, and I must admit that I'm not quite certain how much more open Saudi Arabia is getting now compared to, I believe, the much more closed society it's had in the past. I don't think anybody could just show up in that country. How did you arrange it, by the way?
So, it's interesting that you bring it up. But first, I want to go back to your remembering key pivotal events, because it's important, because that the fact that you do remember key pivotal events is important, not just for understanding individual behavior, but also for understanding policy. Because if you look back at policy, whether it's U.S.-Saudi relations or whether you look at policy between Britain and Saudi Arabia or any other country for that matter, just policy in general, there are key events that trigger either memory or some type of policy change. And obviously 1973 was key, but 1979 and then 1977 and 79 were even more vital in the relationship between the two. Now, going back to your question in terms of how Saudi Arabia, then this is why the first chapter on the whole notion of perception, Western perception, and particularly American perception of Saudi Arabia is so very important. Because we think of, you know, you and I both are activists in many respects on certain issues, especially in regard to Palestine. And we lament and complain all the time about the way mainstream media treats Palestinians, treats Hamas, or treats Fatah, or one of the other, or PFLP, or any of the other Palestinian groups in contrast to Israel, correct?
Oh, indeed so. The U.S. media reports one way on Israel-Palestine. It is really horrendous.
Mm-hmm. Well, the same thing holds true when we look at Saudi Arabia. When coverage, U.S. media coverage, even academic coverage, government documents, policy officials, even regular, ordinary individuals, when you talk to them or you survey them in the United States, they have a particular perception of Saudi Arabia. That perception is defined by mainstream discourse. So you have to look at that, where your understanding is coming from.
I don't follow the major media, Rachel, except to do media critiques, and I usually do it on the print journalism, not television. But they don't generally report very much on international things. The only time they cover international stuff is when America goes to war.
Then it gets
wall-to-wall coverage.
Or there's crises. Like, for example, if you look, most of the time, if you look at U.S. coverage of Saudi Arabia, it's about it's sort of neutral, and it talks more about economic interests, except when there are particular crises, or around election times, when there's particular military packages, when the U.S. government's contemplating selling an arms package to the Saudi government, or there's an energy crisis, or there's potential conflict in the Israeli-Palestinian situation, you have then a change in the way in which it's covered. But if you go back into academia, after the 1970s, you also have a negative tone towards not just the U.S. dependence on Saudi Arabia economically, but more in the terms of human rights. Now, again, this is where we have to look at all the different sources, because think of Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. In some contexts, they are great in their terms of their reporting, but there are also political leanings in some areas.
Oh,
have
they ever? And Human Rights Watch, the same thing, extremely political.
Now I bring that up because one of the things that Saudi Arabia is criticized for is its perceived lack of openness. But let me tell you, I'm single and I'm living in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. I'm living alone in the kingdom. Second, when you walk out on the streets in Riyadh, now I do cover and I do wear the abaya. But you can walk on the streets and you can find many women who are not wearing the abaya. You can go in shopping centers, the same thing. You'll find many women who are not recover. Now, whether you can measure society in terms of openness based on whether one is wearing the hijab, the head cover, or not, is, I don't think, is a very good measure itself. But the point where I'm going with that is it's not, Saudi Arabia is not what it's made out to be publicly. When I look at Saudi society, what I see is the U.S. in the 1980s and 1990s in terms of development. The buildings in Riyadh are phenomenal. They're absolutely beautiful. They would rival any of the architecture in New York and in San Francisco. If you've been to West Palm Beach, Florida, when you travel down the road at night, you have palm trees that line the streets. And there are lights on those palm trees. What was amazing, the other night I was coming back, I was with an Egyptian family. We were coming back from the mall, and along the road, the palm trees were all lit up in lights, and it was just absolutely beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
I think a more serious issue. I mean, it's good to hear that. Well, let me raise one thing. My understanding was, and I'm certainly not up to date on this, that I, as a Jew, would not be welcome in Saudi Arabia because of my religion. Is that as true today as I believe it was at one time?
I don't think that do not quote me on this, and we're doing this live on air, so I believe that changed.
I have no plans to come, Rachel. I'm just curious.
but see, that's the thing. I wish more Westerners would come. I wish there would be more attempts, because this country is not really what it's made out to be. And I've traveled so much between in the Middle East and the United States over the years since 2006. And this is one place, this is one country that I feel at home just like I do in the United States.
Well, that's very interesting to hear. Again, certainly I've never been there, and the only thing I know is what I've read. Again, I don't follow the U.S. media. The reports, I'm trying to recollect things that I have heard reported, not a great deal antagonistic to Saudi Arabia. It's usually related to oil, mm-hmm. and when there's a big weapons purchase, there might be a report that Israel is upset about it. I have a feeling it's more rhetoric than reality. I mean, Saudi Arabia doesn't threaten Israel, and I believe that both countries have they don't have open relations, but they have unofficial relations, so they get along. I'm certain Israel does it with other countries that they may not have official relations with. America does that, but there are other issues that are bigger ones. The issue of governance. The Saudi monarchy rules with an iron hand. There really are no elections. But at the same time, I would compare that to America. America has elections, but they're theater. They're not real. So in that respect, is Saudi Arabia any different from America? It has its monarchy, and America has its own version of a monarchy.
Let me say a little bit about Saudi governance. Because Saudi governance, just like, well, you know, in the U.S. we're used to this whole, even though it doesn't, and obviously with the American awakening, we're seeing more and more Americans are realizing the lack or the loss of the checks and balances that were supposed to be within the system. But in a monarchy, in this type of governance system that it is, and I don't want to go that route, but let me back up.
Okay.
In a monarchy, and in the Saudi government, because the Saudi governance system is more complex than just saying a traditional monarchy. There are societal and political checks and balances that exist here. we don't tend, since, and this goes back to the whole notion of Western perception again, when we look at something, we have a framework of the way in which we think things are supposed to be, or the way in which we understand. We try to relate everything that is in our mind to something that we can understand, to analyze it. That's natural human behavior, regardless of where one is on the ideological, political, or religious spectrum. The same thing within Saudi society. When you look at it from a Saudi perspective, there are checks and balances that exist. It's not necessarily government or governance by an iron fist. The government listens to and must listen to its society. People, especially Westerners, point to the whole situation in the Eastern Province, in Qatif, in particular, as pointing to unrest within inside the kingdom. But it's the kingdom today isn't what it was in the past when there were sparks of unrest. The kingdom today is more solid and cohesive than it was, in terms of not just governance and the political apparatus, but also socially. There are a push in certain areas, but most Saudis, at least with those whom I've talked to from various levels, from your ordinary working class to the academics, most Saudis support the position that change, stable change, occurs over time, and that when you have radical change, it then causes tension and produces the conditions where there may be conflict.
So you see the ruling authorities then being amenable to change taking place over time. Another issue that certainly you'd be interested in, Rachel, is opening up more to women, allowing women to have more of a say. It seems strange that, unless the West is reporting this wrong, that women are not allowed to drive a car. Is that true?
You know, I get frustrated. I get frustrated at this, because the West does use that as a measure of women's freedom. Okay, how long did it take the United States before women could vote?
It took 100 years. It took 100 years struggle, Rachel.
I know. But the whole thing is, the whole point into the driving issue, can women drive? No. But I don't think that is an accurate measurement of policies toward women and gender in particular.
The only reason I bring it up is it seems silly not to let women drive. I mean, driving. You know, if you have a car, you drive. If you don't have a car, you take the bus or something. But it certainly isn't a major issue that should be a point of contention. But yet, it seems a policy that to me seems very, very silly.
Here's the thing. First, I love the fact, maybe this is because, for years when I was working on my master's, I was living in Cumberland, Maryland, and pursuing my master's at American University in D.C. So every time I had class, which was usually about three to four nights a week, I was traveling down to D.C. So that was two and a half hours each way, so a total of 5 hours a day that I was driving for 2 years. And then when I went to West Virginia for my doctorate, it was still traveling on an hour and 20 minutes each way every single day. And I did that for three more years after finishing an American. So I love the fact that I have a driver. I love the fact that I don't have to get in the car and fight traffic. Riyadh traffic is comparable to New York traffic. although I would say maybe not as bad as New York, maybe comparable, more comparable to D.C. traffic.
Well, Rachel, I'd be very delighted if I had a driver take me any place I wanted to go. I think that would be lovely. I mean, it would save me the trouble of needing a car. Well, I don't have a car. I had one once, but I live in downtown Chicago. I don't need a car, but I did for many, many years. And even all during all those years, it would have been lovely if I had somebody drive me around every time I wanted to go someplace.
But the whole thing, no, I don't need to drive if I don't, and it took me 3 weeks before I had the very first time I used my driver. Because I have, the market is like, is right down, from where I'm living. So I can just walk to the market. There's a pharmacy. I mean, I'm in an excellent location in the center of Riyadh. So I don't necessarily need the driver unless I have to go to, faraway places.
I can do the same thing. To do grocery shopping, I can walk and get them and walk back, no problem. let me raise a very, very serious issue. I mean, just an issue that concerns everybody in the region. America boils the pot, and the pot is boiling right now against Syria and against Iran, and the threat is very real that we'll see another war in the region. Syria absolutely is target one right now, but following Syria, it could be Iran. If there's another war in the region and it becomes a little bit more intense than maybe those planning it intend, it will have an effect across the entire region. What is the thinking, to your knowledge, among the Saudis as to how this might affect them adversely, even though they're very close to America?
Well, see, this is where looking at Saudi policy. Saudi policy over the years, and now my time frame of examining from Saudi policy is from 1973 to the present. But I am familiar with Saudi policy going all the way back to the early 1920s. Saudi policy over the different kings, its governance itself can be defined as pragmatic. So, in terms of whether there's actual war with Iran or whether there's war in Syria, Saudi policy will be pragmatic, just as it has always been in the past. Even if it doesn't occur and Assad stays in power or Ahmadinejad and the Iranian governance system stays intact, Saudi policy will continue being pragmatic. I think what's more of a concern to the kingdom at this point is Yemen and the situation in Iraq. And I think that overall, if you look at its policy initiatives, it's attempting to promote stability in the region. And that is the direction that I think it will go.
How does it promote stability by having its troops in Bahrain and this extreme violence that goes on there on a daily basis, and the Saudi forces are directly involved in it, along with the Bahraini authorities? I mean, a lot of people are being injured. There have been dozens of killings. The Bahraini government has been extremely brutal. I've written a number of times about it, and Saudi Arabia is very much involved. I know a causeway links both the countries. Bahrain is an island.
Well, we can't, it's not, the policy in Bahrain is not necessarily Saudi-driven, but rather a GCC initiative. And the Bahraini government had requested GCC troops come in to provide assistance. I am not well versed in the nuanced details of the policy itself, because that's not necessarily my focus as of yet. Maybe a couple months from now, as the book develops, I'll look more into the situation. But in terms of Saudi policy in general, that situation, you have to look at it from a GCC perspective, and then what role Saudi plays in the GCC.
The Gulf Cooperation,
I think
Council
it has
countries.
Been, but you know, what's fascinating, and this is where I go back to Saudi, the whole idea, a notion of Saudi pragmatism. Because I think you know, in every situation, you learn. If you have good governance when you learn from a situation. And I think the Bahraini situation provides lessons of the way in which future policy should be addressed. You know, maybe it's, you know, the part of the whole problem throughout the not just the region, but the world itself, is the disconnect between the people and the role that the economy plays in that disconnect. You know, and so policies that are futuristic in nature, those that are looking to, okay, so let's look at the underlying problems here and let's address them. Looking at what's fascinating is if you look, and I hope that Saudi Arabia looks at its policies that it applied when in the 1990s, when there were situations, tension here within the kingdom, back in the 2003 to 2006 period when there were tensions, the government implemented socioeconomic policies to address the underlying causes to prevent future tension. Well, the same thing, you take that model, those policy initiatives, and you apply that to the region or even internationally. In order to we have to look to the future. Every country around the world is in a mess. As an activist, especially an activist in the United States and one of those supporting change in the United States, I'm excited about all with the protests and people on the ground. But at the same time, we have to look for, okay, now what's the solution? So for the region, what I hope the Saudi government does is looks at, okay, let's look at the underlying causes. What sparked the situation in Bahrain? What sparked the situation in Syria, in Yemen, in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, in all the different countries, in Jordan, where there's tensions that exist? Let's look at the underlying factors. What is it that is common? And let's address them.
I can tell you one of the common denominators, not entirely across every country, but one common denominator is the meddling of America in the internal affairs of other country, often belligerently. And I cite international law a great deal. People think I'm a lawyer, but I'm not, Rachel. but it's very easy to look up relevant international law. I think the earliest example was 1933, a year before I was born, the Montevideo Convention on the Rights and Duties of States. It's very explicit. And this is international law. I mean, this is firm international law, also recognized in subsequent international law, that no nation has the right to meddle in the internal affairs of another. There's only one exception. If that other nation attacks you, then you can respond in self-defense, but only until the Security Council acts, it has the final word, but only self-defense against belligerence lets a country interfere in the affairs of another. No other reason. There are no other reasons. So any country that does it, and none do it more often and egregiously than America, these are illegal acts, and these are things I write about all the time, Rachel.
Mm-hmm. You know, and this is...
We're just about out of time.
I know. The beautiful thing, though, with what's taking place in the borders of the United States and on the ground and among the people is the awakening. Because the key to checking U.S. foreign policies can only come from within. It can only come from the people. It can only come from the street. And once there are... there's more realization from that among Americans that America is in the situation it is economically, politically, and socially because of its policies and the way in which we as Americans have permitted them to go unchecked for all these years.
I agree with you absolutely. There's an awful lot of indifference. It began changing only a few months ago, but the numbers are too small, and I'm talking about Occupy Wall Street. But there needs to be a mass awakening that the only way to pressure a government is for people to do it on their own, because the government will never do it by itself. Rachel, we are out of time. I mean, the time, it doesn't matter whether we're on for 30 minutes or an hour and 30 minutes or the whole morning or afternoon. There's never enough of it. Rachel, I look forward to getting you back again. You're going to be there. Are you going to be there until the book comes out?
Yeah, I'll be here until the end of August, hopefully September. I hope to stay longer, but right now my contract is only until September.
Well, I wish you luck. I hope the book gets out on time. When it comes out, I absolutely want to have you back to talk about it, but I welcome you back anytime, Rachel. And I must say, I was a little on edge wondering if the Saudis really would let you come on the air with me. They may know a little bit about what I write about. They let you do it, so I appreciate that. My hat's off to
The Saudis and the Saudi government is not at all. It's not exactly what people perceive it to be.
Well, I'm very grateful that this program came off just fine, and I feel comfortable that I can get you back again while you are still
anytime
in the kingdom.
Anytime.
Thanks, Rachel, very, very much.
Thank you.
Remind my listeners, on the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, make it a regular habit.